vehicles. We don't need either of them. Let me send Spetsnaz troops disguised as shipyard or factory workers to attack the police station and television station.
Dugin, I can't let you do that.
Kosygin, let?
Dugin, they're professionals. We need amateurs. This has to look like a revolt that springs up across the nation, not like an invasion.
Kosygin, why? Who do we have to mollify, the United Nations? Half the army and air forces and two-thirds of the navy of the Soviet Union belong to Russia. We control 520,000 army troops, 30,000 strategic rocket forces, 110,000 air defense forces, 200,000 navy personnel.
Dugin, we can't break faith with the entire world.
Kosygin, why not? I can seize Poland and then take the Kremlin. When we have power, what does it matter what Washington or anyone else thinks?
Dugin,
and how will you control Poland when it's time to move on? Martial law? Even your troops would be spread too thin.
Kosygin,
Hitler made object lessons of entire villages. It worked.
Dugin,
a half century ago, yes, not today. Satellite dishes, cellular telephones, and fax machines make it impossible to isolate a nation and break its spirit. I've told you before this must be a groundswell, and it must be guided by the officials and leaders who are already in place. People who can be bought, but whom the Poles trust. We can't afford chaos.
Kosygin,
what about the promise of broader powers when they win the elections there in 2 months? Isn't that enough to move the constables and mayors?
Dugin,
it is. But they've also insisted on bank accounts if they lose.
Kosygin,
bastards.
Dugin,
don't fool yourself, General. We're all bastards.
Just stay calm. I've alerted Shovich that the shipment will be late, and he's told his agents.
Kosygin,
how did he take it?
Dugin, he said he used to mark time by scratching lines on the wall of his cell. A few hash marks more won't bother him.
Kosygin, I hope so for your sake.
Dugin,
everything is still on track, merely delayed.
Instead of 24 hours from now, we'll be toasting our new revolution 40 hours from now.
Kosygin,
I hope you're right, Minister. One way or another, I promise you, I will go to Poland.
Good evening, Minister.
Dugin,
good evening, General.
And stay calm. I won't disappoint you.
When the transmission ended, Orlov felt the way he had the first time he was spun in a centrifuge during cosmonaut training, disoriented and sick. The scheme was to take over Eastern Europe, oust Zhanin, and build a new Soviet empire, and it was ingenious in its evil way. A communist newspaper in a small Polish town is blown up. The communists in cities from Warsaw to the Ukrainian border counterattack hard, well out of proportion to the blast, and Dugin gets his groundswell as old-time communists become encouraged. There were still a lot of them who respected the way Władysław Gomułka tossed out the Stalinists in 1956 and formed Polish-style communism with its odd hybrid of socialism and capitalism. Poland is torn in two as the old Solidarity alliances are revived, and, with the Church, they begin railing against the communists, just as they did when the Polish Pope urged Catholics to make Lech Wałęsa president. Closet communists come out in the open, leading to a replay of the strikes, lack of food and other goods, as well as the disorder that Poland experienced in 1980. Refugees pour into the rich Ukrainian West so they can eat. Old tensions between Catholics and the Ukrainian Orthodox Church are fired up. Polish troops and tanks are called in to stem the exodus, and Kosygin's troops are used to escort the refugees back to their homes in Poland. Those troops don't leave. And then the Czechs or Romanians become the next target. Orlov felt as if he were dreaming, not only because of the events that were about to unfold, but because of the position in which he'd placed his son. To stop Dugin, it would be necessary to order Nikita not to turn over the cargo that had been entrusted to him, and perhaps to take up arms against anyone trying to claim the crates. If Dugin were victorious, Nikita would be executed. If Dugin lost, Orlov knew his son. Nikita would feel as though he'd betrayed the military. Then there was also the possibility that Nikita would disobey his father. If that happened, Orlov would have no choice but to arrest him after the train had stopped and the cargo had already been delivered. Insubordination or disobedience of orders carried a prison sentence of 1 to 5 years, and not only would it be the final break between them, but Masha would take it much harder than the trouble Nikki had had back at the academy. Since the transcript and even the broadcast could have been faked at the center, digitally cobbled together from earlier recordings, there was nothing he could take to President Zhanin as evidence of treason. But the crates must not be delivered, and that was something he could tell the Kremlin. In the meantime, he hoped he could convince his son that Dugin, a man who had served his country selflessly and had helped to prevent the boy's expulsion from the academy, was now an enemy of that country. Colonel Roski had not been resting. Corporal Valentin Abelyev had gone home, leaving Roski alone in his office. He had been listening to communications between the offices at the center, using a system that had been installed for him by the late Pavel Odinya. It was because Pavel had put it in, and because no one else could ever know about it, that the communications expert had had to die on the bridge. Pavel was not a military man, but that didn't matter. Sometimes even the loyal service of civilians must result in death. It was like the tombs of ancient Egypt, the security of which was ensured by the death of their designers. There could be no room for sentiment where national security was concerned. Spetsnaz officers were expected to kill any man who was wounded or who hesitated. Deputy commanders were expected to murder commanders who failed to kill the wounded or cowardly. If necessary, Roski would take his own life to protect a state secret. The outside telephones and internal communications net at the operations center were both linked to Roski's computer. But there were also electronic bugs, as fine as human hair, threaded through electrical outlets, inserted into air vents, and hidden beneath rugs. Each microphone had a key code on his computer. That way, Roski could listen to any of the conversations using headphones, or the conversations could be recorded digitally for playback or electronic transmittal directly to Minister Dugin. Roski had sat with his lips pressed tightly together as he played back the conversation between Orlov and his son. Then he listened as General Orlov ordered Titov to tap into the minister's conversation with General Kosygin. How dare he, Roski thought. Orlov was a popular man, a figurehead who had been hired because his fame and charisma were needed to get money from the finance minister for the operations center. Who was he to question the actions of Minister Dugin and General Kosygin? And now Roski listened as General Orlov, this much-decorated hero, told his son that upon receiving word of his destination, he was to proceed there, and upon arriving, to refrain from turning over the crates to Minister Dugin's representatives. General Orlov said he would send his own team from the Naval College to confiscate the cargo. Though Nikita acknowledged the order, Roski could tell his heart wasn't in it. That was good. The boy would not be charged with treason and executed along with his father. Roski would gladly have committed the murder himself, but Minister Dugin did not allow lawless tactics among his lieutenants. Before the center had become operational, the minister had instructed Roski to get in touch with him, and he would contact General Mavik, Marshal of Artillery, if it was necessary to have any of Orlov's orders countermanded. When General Orlov radioed Major Levski, commander of the 12-man Molot team, and ordered him to prepare for a flight to Bira, Colonel Roski had heard enough. He entered a computer code that accessed a private line, a direct line to the Ministry of the Interior, and apprised Minister Dugin of the situation. Dugin said he would contact General Mavik to arrange for Orlov's departure, and instructed Roski to begin making plans to assume control of the operations center. Chapter 45. Tuesday, 8:35 a.m., south of the Arctic Circle. Lieutenant Colonel Squires looked on absently as Ishii Honda checked the communications gear in his rucksack. While they were on the 76T, they used the airplane's uplink to talk to Op Center. Once they were on the ground, however, they would be using the miniature black antenna tucked into the side of the ruck, next to the radio itself. Honda knelt and unfolded the legs and arms of the 17-inch diameter unit, checking to make sure that each prong was fully extended. He screwed the antenna's black coaxial cable into the radio, slipped on his headset, and listened as the system went through a self-calibration check. Then he checked the microphone, counting backward from 10, and gave Squires an OK signal. Next he checked the Global Positioning System receiver, a remote control-sized device with a luminous digital readout stored in a side pocket of the rucksack. He sent out a quarter-second signal, which would enable him to make sure the device was working and yet wouldn't give the Russians time to fix their position. Private Devone was entrusted with the team's compass and altimeter, and would be responsible for getting them to the extraction point once the mission was completed. Having woken from a nap, Sergeant Chick Gray checked his TAC-3 assault vest. Instead of containing a gas mask and 9mm submachine gun magazines, the pouches contained the C-4 they'd need for the mission. Before parachuting into Russia, all the Stryker members would don their warm, rigid Nomex gloves, balaclavas, coveralls, goggles with shatterproof lenses, Kevlar vests, and assault boots. Then they would check the equipment in their TAC-3 overvests, as well as the repelling belts, the thigh pockets with flashbang grenades, and their H&K 9mm MP5A2 submachine guns and Beretta 9mm pistols with extended magazines. Only one thing was missing, Squires felt. He would have traded all the hot high-tech gear for a small fleet of fast attack vehicles. Once they were on the ground in Russia, there wouldn't be much that Ops Center could do to help them with the train or extraction. We had a couple of FAVs to get them across the rocks and ice at 80 miles an hour, with maybe an M60E3 machine gun forward and a rear-seated gunner with a 50-caliber machine gun. Now that would be nice. Hell to parachute down and assemble, but nice. Squires walked to the cabin to stretch his legs and get an update from the crew. Everyone was feeling good about not having been contacted by the Russians, pilot Matt Mazur noting that it wasn't a tribute to their stealth and cunning but to the massive amounts of air traffic. After checking the map and seeing how far they had left to go across the Arctic Ocean, and then down the Bering Sea and southwest over Japan, Squires returned to the cabin, just in time to receive a call from Mike Rogers. Now that the 76T was within range of the Russian receivers, the call was being relayed through a radio link Defense Minister Niskanen had set up in the tower at Helsinki so it couldn't be traced back to Washington. "This is Squires, sir," he said when Honda handed him the receiver. "Colonel," said Rogers, "we have a new development with the train. The Russian unit has stopped and taken on passengers, civilians. There appear to be anywhere from 5 to 10 men and women in each of the cars." Squires took a moment to digest the information. He and his squad had practiced train-clearing exercises with terrorists and hostages, where the enemies were fewer in number and the civilians anxious to leave. But this was something different. "Understood, sir," Squires said. "There are soldiers in each car," Rogers said. His voice sounded drawn, almost defeated. "I've gone over the photos of the train. You're going to have to get flashbangs in through the window, then disarm the soldiers and offload everyone. When you've done that, we'll contact Vladivostok and tell them exactly where to find the passengers. Leave them with whatever cold-weather supplies you can spare." "I understand." "Extraction time is at the bridge I told you about earlier," Rogers said. "Pickup is exactly at midnight. You'll have 8 minutes before the extraction craft leaves, so make sure you get there. The Congressional Intelligence Committee wouldn't give us any more time than that." "We'll be there, sir," Rogers said. "I've got some serious reservations about this one, Charlie, but there doesn't seem to be any alternative. If it were up to me, I'd have hit the train from the air, but for some reason Congress frowns on killing enemy soldiers. It's better to risk our own." "It's the job we signed up for, sir," Squire said. "And you know me, General. It's the kind of job I like." "I know," Rogers said. "But the officer in charge of the train, a junior lieutenant named Nikita Orlov, isn't one of those kids who joined the army for a regular meal. According to what little we have on file about him, he's a fighter, the son of a hero cosmonaut who has something to prove." "Good," Squire said. "I'd hate coming all this way just to walk through a mission, sir."
"Colonel, it's me," Rogers said sternly. "Save the bravura for the troops. More than wanting the train stopped, I want my Strykers back. Do you understand?"
"I understand, sir," Squire said.
After wishing him good luck, Rogers hung up and Squires handed the phone back to Ishihonda. The radio officer returned to his seat and Squires looked at his watch, which he hadn't bothered to reset as they zipped through the time zones. Another 8 hours, he thought. Folding his hands on his belt, he extended his legs and shut his eyes. Before joining Stryker just 7 months before, he'd spent time at the Army's Natick Research and Development Center outside of Boston. There, he'd taken part in experiments designed to produce a uniform that instantly mimicked its surroundings like a chameleon. He'd worn uniforms with light-sensitive sensors that adjusted the light output of the cloth. He'd sat around while chemists toyed with the silk gene to create a synthetic fiber that changed color automatically. He'd tried to move in a comparatively bulky but remarkable EPS, electrophoresis suit, that had liquid dye poured between layers of plastic fabric, electrically charged particles coloring one or the other fabrics depending upon where and how strongly an electric field was applied. He remembered thinking at the time that before the century was out, camouflage suits, invisible stealth tanks, and robot probes could make it possible for the United States to wage virtually bloodless wars. How the scientists would become the heroes and not the soldiers. He was surprised to find that that thought had saddened him, for while no soldier wanted to die, part of what drove all the fighters he ever knew was the desire to test themselves, to be willing to risk their lives for their country or their comrades. Without that danger, that price, that hard-fought victory, he wondered if anyone would cherish their freedoms as much. With that thought on his mind, and Roger's voice still resonant in his ears, Squires drifted asleep, thinking that at least there would always be chicken fights in the base pool, his son on his shoulders, and Private George falling backward, a look of surprise on his face.
Chapter 46, Tuesday, 2:06 p.m., St. Petersburg. Several hours before reaching the coast of Russia, Peggy James and David George got 27 minutes to taste the clean morning air of the Gulf of Finland. Then they re-entered the mini-sub and undertook the second half of their journey. It was less than Peggy had wanted, but enough to keep her going. An hour before reaching the coast of Russia, Captain Rudman lowered himself from his perch in the conn and squatted in the narrow space between the hull and his passengers. Both Peggy and George had already checked their gear in the waterproof rucksacks and were struggling into their Russian uniforms. George looked away as Peggy wriggled into her blue skirt. Rudman did not. After she finished, Rudman flipped open a 12x14x6-inch black metal box on the hull to the left of his head, then whispered,
"When we surface, I'll give you 60 seconds to release the raft. You do that by tugging this pin."
He hooked his finger through a ring attached to a nylon string, then pointed to the paddles on the top and bottom of the compressed raft.
"These unfold in the middle. The raft has Russian markings that coincide with your documents," he said, "indicating that you're with the Argus-class submarine group operating out of Kaporsky Zalif. I believe you've been briefed about this."
"Briefly," said George. "How do you say that in Russian?" Peggy asked.
George squinted as he thought.
"Medlenna," he said triumphantly.
"That means slowly," she said, "but it's close enough. Captain," she looked at Rudman, "why just 60 seconds? Don't you have to replenish your air and batteries?"
"We can run another hour on them, enough time to get us out of Russian waters. Now then, I suggest you give your maps another look. Memorize the area nearest your drop-off point."
Peggy said, "Pyatyagovskaya Shose runs past the park. We follow it east to Prospekt Starchek, head north to the river, and the Hermitage is to the east."
"Very good," said Rudman. "And you know about the workers, of course."
She looked at him. "No. What workers?"
"It was in the newspapers, for God's sake. Several thousand workers are scheduled to assemble in Palace Square tonight to mark the beginning of a 24-hour nationwide strike. It was announced yesterday, called by the Russian Federation of Free Trade Unions to obtain back wages and salary and pension increases for its workers. They're holding it at night so as not to frighten away tourists."
"No," she said, "we didn't know about it. Our myopic organizations can tell you what President Zhanin read in the loo, but they don't follow the news."
"Unless that's what he was reading," George pointed out.
"Thank you, Captain," Peggy said. "I appreciate all you've done for us."
Rudman nodded once, then shimmied back into the conn to guide the midget submarine through the last leg of its journey. Peggy and George were silent again as the submarine hummed through the deep. The English agent tried to decide whether having thousands of civilians and police gathered at the target site would help or hinder the process of getting inside. Help, she decided. The police would be too busy keeping irate Russian workers in line to bother with a pair of Russian sailors. The departure from the submarine was accomplished quickly. After using the periscope to ascertain that there were no boats nearby, the submarine broke the surface. Rudman quietly unscrewed the hatch, and Peggy climbed through. They were about a half mile from shore, and the air was thick with a dirty layer of smog. She doubted that anyone could see them, even if they'd been watching, as George handed her the surprisingly heavy rubber package. Still standing in the conn, she hooked her finger through the ring and tossed the raft overboard. It was fully inflated when it hit the water. Her arms braced stiffly on the sides of the conn. Peggy tucked her knees to her chest, brought her legs out, stood poised for a moment on the sloping side of the mini-sub, then stepped into the raft. George followed a moment later with the paddles. He passed them down to Peggy, then handed her their rucksacks and joined her in the raft.
"Good luck,"
Rudman said, poking his head from the con for a moment before shutting the hatch. The midget submarine was gone less than 2 minutes after breaking the surface, leaving Peggy and George alone on the gentle waters. They didn't speak as they paddled ashore, Peggy watching for the distinctive stiletto-like peninsula that marked the northern boundary of the large cove that bordered the park. The current was with them, and they paddled rapidly in order to stay warm. The icy winds slashed right through the jackets of their uniforms, with their plunging V-necks and thin, blue-and-white striped T-shirts beneath them. Even the tight blue headbands of their white caps were barely strong enough to hold them on their heads. The duo made it to shore in slightly over 45 minutes. They arrived in a park that was relatively deserted where it met the chilly shore. Private George used the tow line to secure the raft to one of several piles. While hitching on her backpack, Peggy complained loudly, in Russian, about having to check naval buoys when it was so chilly. As she did, she looked around. The nearest person was some 200 yards away, an artist sitting in a collapsible lawn chair beneath a tree, drawing a charcoal portrait of a blonde-haired tourist, while her boyfriend looked on approvingly. The woman was looking in their direction, but if she saw them, she didn't react. A militiaman walked along a shaded footpath a few yards beyond them, while a bearded man napped on a bench, a Walkman on his chest, and a St. Bernard resting on the grass beside him. A jogger ran past the artist. Peggy had never thought of runners or anyone else having leisure time in Russia. It seemed an odd sight. Less than 2 miles to the south of the park, planes were landing regularly in the St. Petersburg airport. The roar of the engines disturbed the tranquility of the setting. But that was the paradox of Russia. The brutish rudeness of the modern day allowed to smother the beauty of the old. She looked north, toward the city itself. Through the filmy sky, she saw the array of blue domes, gold domes, white cupolas, Gothic spires, bronze statues, winding waterways and canals, and countless flat brown roofs. It was more like Venice or Florence than like London or Paris. Keith must have loved coming here. Private George completed his task and walked over after pulling on his backpack. "Ready," he said softly. Peggy looked toward the broad Pyatigorskaya Chaussee less than half a mile away. According to the map, if they followed the road east, they would reach the metro station. A change at the Technological Institute station would bring them right to the Hermitage. As they set out, Peggy chattered in Russian about the condition of the buoys and how the maps showing the currents required updating. The man on the bench watched them go. Without moving his hands, which were folded on his belly, he spoke into the thin wire hidden in his shaggy beard. "This is Ronash," he said. "Two sailors have just come ashore at the park and left their raft. Both are wearing backpacks and walking east." Breathing deeply, Roski's undercover operative turned his eyes back toward the beautiful Finnish girl and decided that on his next stakeout, he would most definitely be an artist. Chapter 47, Tuesday, 6:09 a.m., Washington, D.C. It had been an uneventful night for Paul Hood. He'd managed to locate Sharon and the kids at Bloopers the night before, and after hearing about the jelly bean burger and turkey ice cream soda, he'd stretched out on the couch in his office while Kurt Hardaway ran the evening shift. A former CEO of Shawn Corp, which provided navigation software to the military, Hardaway was an effective manager, a dynamic leader, and was familiar with the ins and outs of government. He had retired at 65, a millionaire, joking that he would have been a billionaire if he'd sold to private industry rather than the government. He once told Hood, "I never skimp on quality, however little the government is paying. I don't want some kid sitting in the cockpit of a Tomcat thinking, all of this stuff was provided by the lowest bidder." Unofficially, both Paul Hood and Mike Rogers were off duty after 6 p.m. Officially, however, neither man was relieved until he left the premises. And while they were here, neither Night Director Bill Abram nor Kurt Hardaway ever attempted to "take the bones away from those two dogs," as Hardaway put it. As he lay there through the night, his shoes off, feet on the padded armrest, he thought about his family. The people he didn't want to let down most, yet seemed to disappoint every which way he turned. Maybe that was inevitable. You let down the people closest to you because you know they'll be there when you get back. But boy, did it rip the conscience to ribbons. Ironically, the people he really seemed to have pleased yesterday were the people with whom he had the least in common,
Liz Gordon and Charlie Squires. One, because he'd acknowledged something she'd done by using it in a planning session. The other, because he was letting him go ahead with a once-in-a-lifetime mission. Between short snatches of sleep, Hood also stared at the countdown clock as it crept toward the extraction time they'd set for the Tundra Striker mission. 25 hours, 50 minutes and counting, he thought, looking at it now. It had been 37 odd hours, when Hardaway had first said it. How would we all feel when it cashed out at all zeros, Hood wondered. Where would the world be then? It was at once depressing and strangely exhilarating. In any case, looking at the clock was better than watching CNN. The airwaves were full of the New York bombing and a possible relationship to the attack on the newspaper in Poland. Then there was Ewald Ekdahl ranting about his ties to the Ukrainian opposition force, soldiers who objected to the Russian incursion. That was smart, Hood had to admit. The miserable thug was swinging American opinion toward the Russian-Ukrainian Union by speaking stridently against it. Hood was awakened with word from the midget submarine, relayed via Helsinki, that Private George and Peggy James had been put ashore in St. Petersburg. 5 minutes later he was informed by Mike Rogers, who hadn't slept much, that the 76T had crossed into Russian airspace and was speeding toward the drop point. It was expected to arrive in 20 minutes. Rogers told him that the chaff the 76T dropped when it neared the coast disoriented the watching post at Nahotka, long enough for the plane to slip into the air lanes with the other transports. So far, no one had paid the plane any attention. "Air defense didn't react to the jamming?" Hood asked incredulously.
"We only did it to conceal where they were coming from," Rogers said. "Once the 76T was in Russia, nothing appeared out of the ordinary. Our crew is maintaining radio silence, and on the way out they'll inform Nahotka that they're going to Hokkaido to pick up replacement parts for decoy transmitters."
"I still can't believe we slipped through so easily," Hood said.
"For the last couple of years," Rogers said, "the Russians have been more huff than puff. The soldiers manning the radar have been working longer shifts than we have. If nothing stands out as strange, it's unlikely they're going to catch it."
"Are you so sure that's it?" he asked. "Or could this be one of those traps that let a mouse in and don't let it out again?"
"We considered that possibility when we were planning the operation," Rogers said. "There would have been no reason for the Russians to risk letting a strike force get on the ground. The truth is, Paul, the Russia you were worried about is no longer the Russia of reality."
Hood said, "There's still Russia enough to have us snacking on fingernails."
"Touché," said Rogers.
Hood rose, phoned Bugs Benet, told him to send the department heads to the tank, then went into his private washroom to scrub the sleep from his eyes. As he dried off, he couldn't stop thinking about Russia. Was Mike right about Russia, or were they all just delusional, caught up in a false euphoria about the fall of Russian communism and the Soviet Union? Had it really fallen at all? Was this just a dream, smoke and mirrors, an interstitial period like the lulls between the great ice ages? Had the dark forces merely withdrawn from the spotlight to regroup and return, stronger than before? Russians were not used to initiative and freedom. They had been ruled by dictators since the days of Ivan the Terrible. Since Ivan Grozny, he thought with alarm. As he headed for the tank, Hood did not believe that, however the next day's events turned out, the evil empire was dead at all. Chapter 48, Tuesday, 2:29 p.m. St. Petersburg. During his first space mission, General Orlov had not been able to speak with Masha, and when he returned, he found her emotionally taut. She pointed out to him that that was the first time since they'd known each other that a day, let alone three, had gone by without them talking to one another. He'd thought, at the time, that it was a silly woman's emotion he couldn't understand. But then when Nikita was born, and she bled profusely and was unable to speak, he realized what a solace just hearing the voice of your loved one could be. If she could only have told him, "I love you," those long days of sitting by her bedside would have been easier. He never again let a day pass without speaking to her, and was surprised to find how even the briefest talk anchored him as much as it did her. Although Masha was not supposed to know what he did at the Hermitage, he had told her. Though he did not tell her specifics or go into detail about personnel, other than Roski, he had to have someone to complain to about him.
After calling Marcia at 10:30 in the morning and telling the disappointed woman that business is so good he wasn't sure when he'd be back, Olaf had gone to the command center. He'd wanted to be with his team to mark the passage of the first day's operational halfway point. Ruski had come in at a few minutes past 11, and both he and Olaf assumed what had quickly become their unofficial posts in the command center. Olaf walked slowly behind the bank of computer operators, each of whom was monitoring a section of the intelligence firmament. Ruski stood behind Corporal Yevashin, monitoring the pipeline to Dugin and the other ministers in the Kremlin. Ruski was even more intense and focused than usual as he followed military and political developments. Olaf didn't think the impending arrival of the two operatives from Finland would put him on such high personal alert like this, though he decided not to ask him about it. Questions to Colonel Ruski did not seem to elicit useful answers. At 1:30, the operations center intercepted a report from the air defense station at Nahotka to the intelligence office of the Marshal of the Air Force that their radar had gone haywire for nearly 4 minutes, but that everything seemed to be all right now. While air defense checked the electronic beacons of all the aircraft in the region against their radar blips to make sure there were no intruders, Olaf knew that it was the 76T from Berlin that had caused the disruption. It was now in Russian airspace and headed west, less than an hour from intercepting the train, if that was its intention. He had immediately phoned Titov's afternoon counterpart in the radio room, Grigory Stanyan, to contact the marshal's office so he could speak with him. He was told the marshal was in a conference. "This is urgent," Olaf said. Ruski asked Yevashin for his headphones.
"Let me talk to them," he said.
While Olaf continued to listen on the telephone, Ruski was put through to Marshal Pietrov. Olaf saw the glint of satisfaction in the colonel's eyes.
"Sir," Ruski said, "I have a call for you from General Sergei Orlov at the Operations Center in St. Petersburg."
"Thank you, Colonel," Pietrov said.
It was a moment before Orlov could speak. For the head of an intelligence operation, he was suddenly feeling very ignorant and very vulnerable. Orlov told the marshal about the 76T, and Pietrov said that he had already scrambled a pair of MiGs to escort it to a landing or shoot it down. Olaf hung up, and, his eyes still locked on Ruski's, he strode over.
"Thank you," the general said.
Ruski drew his shoulders back.
"You're welcome, sir."
"I know the marshal socially, Colonel."
"You are fortunate, sir."
"Do you know him?" Olaf asked.
"No, sir,"
Ruski said.
"Then explain."
Though Orlov's voice was soft, he was commanding, not asking.
"I don't understand, sir."
Orlov knew now for certain that the conversation with Pietrov, and now with him, was a game. But he wasn't about to get into a public power struggle in the command center, one he might well lose.
"I see," Orlov said. "Go about your duties, Colonel."
"Yes, sir,"
Ruski said. Orlov returned to his post, beginning to suspect that even his appointment here had been part of a larger game. As he saw Dyelev, Spansky, and others snatch quick glances at him, the only question he had was who was loyal to him here, who might have been in on it from the beginning, and who, like Pietrov, may have been brought in over the last few hours. The scope of the deception surprised him, but it didn't hurt as much as the thought that friends would desert him to preserve or advance their careers. Orlov returned to his position behind the computer bank, though it was not the same position as when he had left it. The power base had shifted palpably to Ruski. Orlov knew he had to regain it. He'd never walked away from anything in his life, and he didn't intend to leave here defeated. But he knew he would have to undermine the colonel quickly and without being underhanded. He couldn't compete with Ruski on that level. Orlov realized there was only one tack he could take, just as Yevashin informed the colonel that the local militia intelligence officer Ronash had called the St. Petersburg station house. Ruski took the headphones, pressed one to his ear, and listened in silence as Sergeant Lysychev of the local militia told him what Ronash had seen. The colonel moved the attached microphone closer to his mouth.
"Sergeant," he said, "tell Ronash to follow those two. They're the ones we want. They'll probably get on the metro. If they do, tell him to go with them and have plainclothesmen watching for them at the transfer point at the Technological Institute, and also at Gostiny Dvor and Nevsky Prospekt stops. They'll probably get off at Nevsky, and I'll meet your men there.
He listened for a moment, then said, "Red and yellow striped scarves. Yes, I'll watch for them."
Ruski handed the earphones back to Yevashin, then walked over to Orlov. He stepped in close and spoke softly.
"You've been loyal to the Center and to Russia," Ruski said, "and have done nothing we would hold against you. For the sake of your pension and your son's career, you will continue to do so."
Orlov said in a strong voice, "Impertinence noted, Colonel. A rebuke will appear on your record. Was there anything else?"
Ruski glared at him.
"Good," said Orlov. He dipped his forehead toward the door. "Now come back prepared to follow orders. My orders. Or report back to Minister Dugin in Moscow."
He knew that Ruski had to leave to catch the agents, although it would appear to the others as if he were obeying Orlov's command.
Ruski turned without saluting and hurried from the command center. Orlov knew that the colonel wouldn't surrender the operation center during a coup. That's what it was, he realized now. And though he remained in the command center, his mind was on Ruski and what the colonel's next step might be.
Chapter 49. Tuesday, 9:30 p.m., Khabarovsk.
"Rearview mirror says we've got company," Pilot Matt Mazur told Squires. The striker had come to the cockpit 3 minutes before the jump to thank the captain for his help.
The radar screen clearly showed two MiG-like blips closing in at approximately 700 miles an hour.
"Be prepared to pop a gasket," Mazur said to co-pilot John Berlich.
"Yes, sir,"
said the rookie, who was cool but was working his chewing gum overtime. The Air Force had cleverly equipped the 76T with an enlarged oil tank that was divided into two compartments, one that fed the plane, the other that could leak with the press of a button. The leaking oil was designed to give the plane a reason to turn around if they were spotted. They could go down at once, if necessary, to avoid being shot down or forced to a Russian airstrip, or this close to the coast they could break away from the pursuit craft and make a run for home. In either case, Squires knew that the 76T would be unlikely to be ferrying them back.
"What do you want to do, sir?" the captain asked Squires.
"We'll jump," he said. "I'll let Ops Center know what's happened and let them figure a way out for us."
The captain took another look at the radar screen.
"In about 90 seconds, the MiGs will be close enough to see you."
"Then we'll jump fast," said Squires.
"I like your style, sir," the captain said, saluting.
Jumpmaster Squires hurried back to the cabin. He decided not to tell Stryker what had happened. Not yet. He needed his team to be focused on the job. Though he would be happy to storm hell itself with any of these soldiers at his side, a stray concern at the wrong time by any one of them could cost lives. At the FBI Academy in Quantico, the Stryker team had practiced many kinds of aerial assault, from night jumps to Stabo assaults, with the team hanging from helicopter lines and landing simultaneously on church steeples, cliff sides, and even the tops of moving buses. Each member had the poise, stamina, and smarts necessary for the job. But those in-depth examinations by the doctors, the canker mechanics, were easy. Soldiers were either fit to serve or they weren't. Despite the best efforts of Liz Gordon and her team of psychologists, the real question mark was always how they would hold up under the stress of an actual mission, when there wasn't a fence made of 2x4s to catch them in case they slid off the rooftop, when they knew that the rugged terrain wasn't the survival training site at Camp Dawson, West Virginia, but the mountains of North Korea or the tundra of Siberia. It wasn't for lack of respect or concern that Squires kept the information from them. It was to remove, as much as possible, another distraction from the successful execution of the mission. The Strikers were lined up by the hatch, as they'd been for a half hour. Every 5 minutes the navigator had provided Squires with their precise coordinates, in case it had been necessary for them to jump early. While they stood there, the team prepared for infill. Each member checked another's weapons and rucksacks, making certain they were tight against the chest, back, and sides, and that the ruck and back was firm against the bottom of the parachute, where it wouldn't interfere with deployment. The rappelling equipment was stowed in rucks that three of the Strikers carried at the end of 15-foot tethers that would dangle beneath the soldiers as they fell. The teammates checked their padded leather jump helmets, oxygen masks, and night vision goggles. These were bug-eyed glasses, so heavy that counterweights had to be attached to the backs of the helmet.
After a few months of training with these goggles, most strikers found that their neck sizes had gone up 2 sizes from the building of their neck muscles. At the last moment before the jump hatch was opened, they switched from the oxygen consoles to which they'd been hooked to the bailout bottles strapped to their sides. The darkish, blood-red cabin lights had been turned on, and icy winds slammed mercilessly through the cabin. It was impossible to hear anything but the air rushing by, and as soon as they were over their target and got the go signal, the lime-green jump light, Squires went out the door, pivoting on the ball of his right foot so that he was dropping face down in the frog position. From the corner of his eye, he saw the second team member jump, Sergeant Gray, then looked at the big, round altimeter strapped to his left wrist. The numbers rolled over quickly, 35,000 feet, 34,000 feet, 33. Squires felt the frigid air push against his flesh even through the cold weather clothing, chilling and then stinging him with a combination of cold and fist-hard pressure. He assumed the glide position as he fell, and when his altimeter read 30,000 feet, he tugged the silver ripcord. There was a mild jolt, and his legs swung underneath him. As he drifted down through the dark and cloudless sky, the air warmed perceptibly, though it was still below zero. As team members above him lined themselves up with the luminescent strip on the helmet of the striker beneath them, Squires searched the ground for landmarks, the train track, the bridge, the mountain peaks. They were all there, and that afforded Squires a measure of relief. One of the most important psychological aspects at the start of any mission was being able to hit the target. Not only did that make the soldiers feel capable, but the maps had made them familiar with the terrain in the target area. It was just one less thing to worry about. Though it was dark, the night vision goggles allowed Squires to pick out the target cliff, and to use the riser straps above him on either side to maneuver the shroud lines and guide himself as close to the edge as possible. He had told the strikers that he would be landing in the forward position, and that they were to come in behind him. The last thing he wanted was for one of his people to overshoot the cliff. If they were snagged on a projection, they'd have to be rescued, costing them time. If they landed on the ground, out in the open, they might be seen. Gusts near the ground caught Squires by surprise. He landed just 5 yards from the edge of the cliff. Dropping to his side to reduce the surface he presented to the wind, the officer quickly released his parachute and bundled it in, standing as he watched Sergeant Gray land, then Private Devone and the others. He was proud of them as they landed with precision. Within 5 minutes, the 6 strikers had knotted their parachutes to a tree. Private Devone stayed behind to leave a small incendiary device beneath the bundle. It was set to go off at 12:18 a.m. after the strikers had departed the area, destroying itself and the parachutes and leaving nothing for the Russians to present to the United Nations as evidence of a U.S. incursion. As the strikers huddled around Squires, they could hear distant engines that were more than just the 76T. "Sounds like they've got company," said Private Eddie Medina. "They knew about it, and it's being handled," Squire said. "Private Honda, set up the taxat. Everyone else, get ready to move out." While the 5 other strikers moved out, using pitons and clamps to hook their heavy rappelling lines to the side of the cliff, Squires contacted Op Center. "Wake-up call," he said as Mike Rogers got on the line. "What's the morning like there?"
"Sunny and mild," said Rogers. "Charlie, you know about the MiGs?"
"Yes, sir."
"Okay, we're working on it. The 76T is going to make a run for Hokkaido, but it won't be coming back. We're working on a variation of the original plan. Be at the extraction point at the scheduled time. We'll have an aircraft there."
"Understood."
It was unspoken, but Charlie also understood that if there was a problem, the team would have to find a place to hide. Several sites had been marked on their maps, and the team would go to the closest one if the need arose.
"Good luck," Rogers said before signing off.
Charlie handed the receiver back to Honda. While the radio operator packed up the taxat, Squires took a moment to look across the terrain. It didn't require the eerie green light of the night vision goggles to look dead and desolate beneath the canopy of unnaturally bright stars. The track came toward them in a gentle curve from the plains to the east, passed through a natural path between the cliffs, and continued on across flat scrubland dotted with trees and patches of snow. To the south were mountains. The region was as quiet as anywhere he had ever been. The only sounds were the whistle of the wind in his helmet and the scuffling of the striker's boots against the dirt and loose rocks of the cliff. Honda moved forward when he was finished, and with a final glance toward the eastern horizon from which their quarry would soon be coming, Squires moved to where the strikers were just finishing with their preparations to descend from the ledge.
Chapter 50. Tuesday, 9:32 p.m., Khabarovsk. Nikita had an uncanny sense about aircraft. Growing up at the Cosmodrome, he always heard the approach of helicopters before anyone else did. He could recognize jets by the sounds their engines made. His mother said that all those years his father had spent in cockpits had affected his genes. Filled them with aviation fuel, was how she'd put it. Nikita didn't believe that. He simply loved flying. But to have become a flyer, to have been compared to the national hero Sergei Orlov, would have been impossible for him. And so he kept his love to himself, like a dream whose magic couldn't be communicated to another. The train slowed as it came to a patch of track with thickly piled snow. Though the wind roared around the canvas flap over the open window, Nikita heard the distinctive drone of the MiG engines. Two of them, coming from the east toward a transport that was flying overhead. These weren't the first aircraft he'd heard, but there was something different about them. He poked his head out the window and turned his left ear up. Though the falling snow made it impossible for him to see anything, the sound traveled clearly through it. He listened carefully. The MiGs weren't accompanying the 76T. They had caught up to it. And as he listened, he heard the 76T and then the jets head in the opposite direction, back toward the east. That wasn't right. This might be the 76T his father had warned him about. Nikita drew his head inside, oblivious to the snow caked on his hair and cheeks.
"Get Colonel Rusky on the radio,"
he bucked to Corporal Fodor, who was sitting at the table warming his hands above the lantern.
"At once,"
the corporal replied as he hurried to the console. While Fodor crouched beside the console, waiting to be patched through to the base on Sakhalin, Nikita's eyes ranged over the civilians they'd picked up as he considered other possible explanations for what he'd heard. A mechanical problem could have caused the transport to turn back, but it wouldn't have needed an escort. Was someone looking for the train, trying to pinpoint their location, attempting to help them? His father, perhaps? General Kosygin? Or could it be someone else?
"He isn't there," Fodor said. "Ask for General Orlov,"
Nikita said impatiently. Fodor made the request and then handed the phone to Nikita.
"He's on, sir."
Nikita squatted.
"General?"
"What is it, Nikki?"
"There's a transport overhead," said Nikita. "It was headed west until a pair of jets arrived, and then it turned."
"That's the 76T, Orlov said.
"What are my orders?" Nikita asked.
"I've asked the President for permission to send troops to meet you in Bira," he said. "I've not received an approval for my request. Until then, do whatever is necessary to protect your cargo."
"As war material or as evidence, sir?"
"That isn't your problem," Orlov snapped. "Your orders are to keep it safe."
"That I will do, sir," Nikita said.
Handing the receiver to Fodor, the young officer hurried to the rear of the car, making his way through the passengers. The five men and two women were sitting on mats playing cards or reading or knitting by lantern light. Nikita pulled open the door and crossed the slippery coupling. Thickly packed snow fell on his shoulders as he pushed open the door. Inside the car, the beefy Sergeant Viersky was talking to one of his men as they kept watch at the window on the northern side. Another man was stationed at the window on the south. All of them snapped to attention as Lieutenant Orlov entered.
"Sergeant," Nikita said, saluting, "I want spotters on the tops of the train. Two men on every car rotated in half-hour shifts."
"Yes, sir," said Viersky.
"If there isn't time to request instructions," Nikita continued, "your men are to shoot anyone who approaches the train."
Nikita looked at the civilians, four men and three women they'd placed in this car at the last station. One of the men was sitting against a crate, napping.
"And don't leave the car unattended at any time, Sergeant.
I won't have my cargo compromised."
"Of course not, sir."
Nikita left, wondering where Rosky had gone, and whether, absent the colonel's orders, he could allow the crates to be turned over to his father. Chapter 51. Tuesday, 6:45 a.m., Washington, D.C.
"Another message from NRO," Bugs Benet said as Hood and the rest of the op center officers sat around the conference table in the tank.
"Thanks," Hood said to the video image of his assistant. "Put it through."
Veens's voice came on, but his picture did not. Instead, a black-and-white image was constructed on the screen at 50 lines a second.
"Paul," said Veens, "we picked this up just 3 minutes ago."
Hood swung the screen partly toward Rogers,
then watched as the white, hazy, moon-like terrain appeared, followed by the train, which occupied roughly one-third of the center of the image. The image was extremely hazy because of the falling snow, but what should have been an unbroken expanse of white on top of the cars was not. There were shadows.
"Sorry for the quality," said Veens. "It's snowing a hell of a lot. But we're certain those shapes on top are soldiers. They're in camouflage whites, so you can't see them per se, though you can make out the shadows."
"Those are soldiers, all right," Rogers said tensely as he pointed a finger to the screen. "You can tell by the way they're arrayed. Last one facing forward toward the left, next one facing back to the right, next one forward right, and so on. These shapes here," he traced a small line near one of the smudges, "appear to be a rifle." Veen said, "That's how we figured it, Mike."
"Thank you, Stephen," Hood said, then switched the NRO chief off. The room was silent, save for the faint hum of the electronic grid surrounding it.
"Can they know that Stryker is on the ground?"
"Very possible," Bob Herbert said as the phone on the desk beeped.
"For you," Rogers said as he glanced at the code number.
Because of the electronic field, Herbert couldn't be reached on the cellular phone attached to his wheelchair. He picked up the phone built into the side of the conference table, punched in his code number, and listened. When he hung up, his face looked waxen.
"The 76T is being escorted home by a pair of MiGs," Herbert said. "They'll start leaking oil and head for Hokkaido, but it won't be going back into Russia."
Rogers looked at his watch, then reached for the phone near him. "I'm going to have the Mosquito go in from Hokkaido."
Herbert slapped the desktop.
"No good, Mike. That's a round trip of 1,000 miles. The Mosquito's range is 700.
"I know what her range is," Rogers shot back. 710.2 miles. "But we can get a cruiser up from the Sea of Japan. She can land on the deck."
"We didn't get committee permission for the Mosquito to fly in solo," Martha McCall said.
"We also didn't get approval for them to exchange fire with Russian soldiers," Lowell Coffey added. "This action was supposed to be reconnoitering only."
"I care about my soldiers," Rogers replied, "not about those blowhards."
"Let's see how we can try to please everyone," Hood said, "and disappoint them all."
"Mike?"
"Yes, sir,"
he said, breathing deeply. "What do we do with Stryker if we abort now?" Rogers took a long, deep breath.
"The Mosquito goes in anyway," he said. "The nearest agent in place who could possibly sneak them out of Asia is in Hegong, Heilongjiang, about 200 miles away, and I won't have them make that trip."
"In China?" Coffey said. "No one in Russia?"
"Our people in Vladivostok became repatriated when the Iron Curtain came down," Rogers said. "We haven't had the resources to recruit others."
"What about lying low until things quiet down?" Phil Katzen asked. "The terrain is survivable."
"The Russians know Stryker's there, damn it," Rogers said. "They've got satellites too, and they'll find them."
He looked at Hood.
"Paul, the best way out of this is straight ahead as planned."
"Straight ahead," said Martha, "to a showdown with Russian soldiers at a time when the country's a tinderbox waiting for a match." "The only way you'd keep that quiet," Coffey warned, "is to kill everyone on the train."
"Is it better to let a war happen?" Rogers countered. "One that would suck in Europe and probably the Chinese? Why do I feel like I'm back in 1945 listening to all the arguments about why we shouldn't use the A-bomb to save American lives?"
Hood said, "Mike, the issue here is American lives. Stryker lives."
"Don't lecture me about Stryker lives, Paul," Rogers said through his teeth. "Please."
Hood sat quietly for a moment.
"Fair enough." Rogers' hands were folded on the table. His thumbs were red and pressing down hard.
"You all right, Mike?" Liz asked.
He nodded and looked at Hood.
"Sorry, Paul. I was out of line."
"Forget it," Hood said. "You and I could both use a movie and popcorn."
"Ooh," said Coffey. "Who's the family man here?"
Hood and Rogers both smiled.
"All right," said Hood. "An R-rated movie."
"Hey, the guy's out of control," Coffey said. "Someone call the excitement police."
Everyone but Anne was chuckling, and Hood tapped a finger on the table to bring them back. "What I was about to say a moment ago," he continued,
is that the diplomats haven't given up on solving this, and no one knows what President Zhanyin will do. Do we jeopardize that by going ahead with the mission?
Whatever they do, Rogers said evenly, the crates on that train represent a lot of power for corrupt people. Even if it doesn't start a war, the cargo places influence in the hands of gangsters. Don't we have a responsibility to try and take that away?
Coffey said,
Our first responsibility is to strike her and the laws we're all supposed to live by.
Laws passed by your friends on the hill, Rogers said, not moral law. You did what was necessary up there, but like Benjamin Franklin said, necessity never made a good bargain.
Rogers looked at Hood.
You know me, Paul. Stryker is dearer than my own life, but doing what's right is more important than both. And stopping that train is right.
Hood listened carefully. Rogers and Coffey were coming at the problem from two directions, and neither of them was wrong. But the call was his, and he hated the fact that he was sitting here in comfort and security, deciding the fate of seven people on a frozen cliff on the opposite side of the world. He input Bugs's code in the computer, and his assistant's face appeared on the monitor.
Yes, Paul?
Signal Stryker on the TACSAT. See if Lieutenant Colonel Squires is free to come on. If not, when it's convenient.
Will do,
Bugs said, and his image winked off.
Rogers didn't look happy. What are you going to do, Paul?
Charlie's the commander in the field, Hood said. I want his input.
He's a professional soldier, Rogers said. What do you think he's going to say?
If he can take the call, let's find out.
You don't do that to a soldier, Rogers said. That's not leadership, it's management. The only question we should be asking is, are we behind Stryker or aren't we? Can we make this commitment and stick to it?
We can, Hood replied coolly. But after your Korean mission, I went back and read the white papers you wrote as part of the ad hoc joint task force planning the rescue of our hostages from Khomeini's Revolutionary Guards. You were right about our forces being ready on paper and not in practice. And you were also right to be very concerned about extracting the advance party of Special Forces soldiers that would infiltrate Tehran a few days before the Eagle Claw mission. Without your prompting, the agents wouldn't have had a plan to get them out of the Mehrabad International Airport on Swiss Air if things went wrong.
Why did you come up with that?
Because sneaking them out one at a time from the safe house would have given the Iranians more time to find them, Rogers said. It made more sense to buy commercial airline tickets and get them the hell out together.
Who did you work that out with? Hood asked.
Ari Moreau, who set up the safe house for us.
Your man on the site, Hood said as Bugs's image reappeared.
Yes, Bugs.
I beeped on his helmet phones. We'll just have to wait.
Thanks, said Hood.
He looked at Rogers again.
This isn't Vietnam, Mike. We're not withdrawing moral or tactical support from our personnel in the field. If Squires wants to go ahead, I'll back him and take the butt-whipping from Congress later.
It's not your call, Rogers quietly reminded him.
Stryker is yours to command, Hood agreed, but going outside the parameters established by the Intelligence Committee is my call.
Bugs came back on.
Lieutenant Colonel Squires is minding the headphones, Paul. I have him on the line.
Hood punched up the volume on the phone link.
Lieutenant Colonel?
Yes, sir,
said Squires, his voice clear despite the crackling caused by the snowfall.
What's your disposition? Hood asked.
Five strikers are nearly down the cliff. Private Neumeyer and I are about to descend.
Lieutenant Colonel, Rogers said, there are Russian soldiers on top of the train. We make out 10 or 11. The all-news network.
Facing north, east, west, and south, Hood knew.
We're concerned about letting you go ahead with the mission, Hood said. What does it look like to you?
Well, sir, Squire said, I've been standing here looking at the landscape.
The landscape, Hood said.
Yes, sir. This looks doable, and I'd like permission to proceed.
Hood caught the glint in Roger's eye. It was a flash of pride, not triumph.
You understand the mission parameters, Hood said.
We don't break any Russians, Squire said. I think we can manage that. If not, we'll abort and head for the extraction point.
Sounds like a plan, Hood said. We'll keep an eye on the train and update you if necessary.
Thank you, sir. General Rogers, as they say in the foothills, Das Vidaniya. See you later.
Chapter 52. Tuesday, 2:52 p.m., St. Petersburg. Peggy stopped at the coin-operated telephone just above the Gribyedeva Canal. After looking around, she pushed 2 kopecks into the coin slot. She answered George's mystified look by saying, "Volka, cellular phone." Right, he thought, the spy. With everything else that was going on, George had forgotten about him. One of the things Stryker operatives had been trained to do was take in their surroundings in a seemingly casual glance, remembering details that most people would have missed. The ordinary person looked at the sky or the sea or a skyline, big, impressive sights. But that wasn't where information tended to be. It was in a glen under the sky, or a cove beside the sea, or a street running past a building. Those were the places Strikers looked. And at people. Always people. A tree or mailbox wasn't a threat to a mission, but someone behind them could be. And because he hadn't looked at the trees in the park or the busy thoroughfare when he'd arrived, Private George noticed that the man who had been napping on the bench was no longer asleep. He was walking slowly less than 200 yards behind them, and his St. Bernard was panting. He had been running to get there, not strolling. Peggy said in Russian, "The Hermitage, Raphael's Conestabile Madonna, left side, every hour and half hour, for 1 minute. After closing, go to Krasny Prospekt, Upper Park, lean on a tree, left arm." The English operative had told him where to meet her and how to stand so she'd know him. She hung up, and they started walking again. "We are being followed," George said in English. "The man with the beard," Peggy said. "I know. This could make things a little easier."
"Easier?"
"Yes," she said. "The Russians know we're here, and the surveillance facility Keith was looking for could very well be involved. Anyway, if that man is wired, we may be able to find it. Do you have a light?"
"Excuse me?"
"A match," she said. "A lighter."
"I don't smoke," George said.
"Neither do I," Peggy said impatiently, "but pat your pockets like you're looking for one."
"Oh, sorry," George said, as he slapped his shirt and pants pockets.
"Fine," Peggy said. "Now wait here."
Almost every soldier in Russia smoked, and though George didn't enjoy it, he, like Peggy, had mastered the art of inhaling the potent Turkish blend favored by Russian and Chinese militiamen, just in case Stryker ever ended up in Asia. But George had no idea what she had in mind as he watched her pull a package of cigarettes from her breast pocket and walk toward the bearded man. As George looked down at the ground, convincingly affecting boredom, the Russian pretended to be waiting for the dog to finish up with the tree, something the dog had no apparent inclination to do. The cigarette poking from her mouth, Peggy was about 10 yards from the man when he turned to walk in the other direction.
"Sir," she said in perfect Russian as she jogged after him, "have you got a match?"
He shook his head as he strolled away. Peggy came up behind him and, in one quick motion, grabbed the leash at the base of the loop that was slung around his left hand. She twisted hard, and in the same motion stepped around so she was facing him. He groaned as the leash cut off the circulation in his fingers. George saw her eyes drop to his beard. She nodded once when she spotted the wire. Peggy faced the Russian and put a rigid finger to her lips, indicating silence. The Russian nodded.
"Thanks for the match," she said, as she led the spy toward George. "That's a lovely dog you have."
She was talking, George knew, to keep the Russians from communicating with their agent. As long as someone was there, they wouldn't expect the Russian to answer their questions. He also realized she couldn't shut it off, or they'd know something was wrong. Except for the fact that he was wincing slightly, it would have appeared to an observer that Peggy and the Russian were friends holding hands as they walked the dog. When they reached George's side, Peggy patted the Russian's left pants pocket with the back of her hand. She reached in, pulled out his car keys, and swept her free hand back and forth. Still grimacing, the Russian pointed toward a row of cars on the far side of the park. She looked at George, who nodded with understanding.
"I'm always surprised at how passive most large dogs are," Peggy said as they walked, the dog lumbering after them. "It's the little ones who cause trouble."
The three of them entered the park and headed toward a row of cars, parked on the other side of the kidney-shaped green. When they had crossed it, the Russian led them to a black 2-door sedan. Upon reaching the passenger's side, Peggy faced the Russian and rapped on the car with a knuckle.
Does she bite?
He shook his head. She turned the leash, and the pain brought the Russian up to the tips of his toes.
Yes, he said. Be careful.
She gave the Russian the keys and indicated for him to open the door. He did, then pointed to the glove compartment. Peggy knelt beside the car so that he could sit down and turn the knob with his right hand. One twist to the left, one to the right, then a full clockwise turn back to the right, opened the compartment. Inside was a gas canister and a switch. George knew from a briefing on taking hostages in place, high-ranking persons instead of ordinary people in the street, that wealthy people, military figures, and government officials often had booby traps in their cars that were triggered automatically in the event of kidnapping. In the case of the Russians, there was typically a noxious gas of some kind that went off after a short time. The abductee, of course, would know when to hold his or her breath. After the Russian disarmed the device, Peggy tugged him out by the hand, took the keys, and handed them to George. She cocked her head toward the driver's side. George went around, climbed in, and started the car while Peggy slid into the back seat with the Russian. With her free hand, she released the dog from its collar and shut the door. The St. Bernard jumped up at the window, barking. Peggy ignored it as she turned down the volume on the Walkman microphone.
"Check for bugs," Peggy said to George, as she settled in beside the Russian.
George removed the handheld bug transmitter locator from his ruck. He swept it around the car and toward the Russian. There was no loud screeching.
"We're clean," said George.
"Good."
George could hear the buzz of voices from the Russian's earphones.
"But I think they're talking to him, probably wondering why the mic has gone dead."
"I'm not surprised," said Peggy, "but they'll just have to wait."
She looked at George in the rearview mirror.
"What are your orders under these circumstances?"
"The manual says that if we're discovered, we disperse and get out."
"Safety first," she said. "Our manual says that, too."
"It's more for security," said George. "We know things the Russians would love to..."
"I know," said Peggy. "But what do you really want to do?"
George replied,
"Find out what's going on at the Hermitage."
"So do I," said Peggy. "So let's see if our friend and his beard can help."
Peggy pulled a dagger from the sleeve behind her lapel and put it under the Russian's left ear. She released the leash and said in Russian,
"What's your name?"
The Russian hesitated, and Peggy pressed the needle-sharp tip of the blade against his superficial temporal artery.
"The longer you take, the more pressure I apply," she said.
The Russian replied,
"Ronash."
"All right, Ronash," said Peggy. "We're going to make sure you don't tell your friends anything in code. So say exactly what I say. Understand?"
"Da."
"Who is in charge of this operation?"
"I don't know," he said.
"Oh, come now," said Peggy.
"A Spetsnaz officer," said Ronash. "I don't know him."
"All right," Peggy said. "Here's what you tell them. This is Ronash, and I wish to speak with the Spetsnaz officer in charge. When he gets on, give me the unit."
Ronash nodded tightly, so as not to run the knife through his throat. George glanced at her in the mirror.
"What are we going to do?" he asked in English.
Peggy said,
"Head for the Hermitage. We'll find a way in if we have to, but I have a better idea."
As George backed the car from the parking area, the dog stopped jumping. It just watched, its great tail wagging as the car pulled away. Then it settled down on the grass, its big head flopping to the side and dragging the rest of its body with it.
So much for industry in the post-Cold War Russia, the striker thought. Even the dogs don't want to do any heavy lifting.
As he swung the car toward the main thoroughfare, and then along the Obvodny Canal, toward the Moskovsky Prospekt, George couldn't help but marvel, by contrast, at the way Peggy had executed her duties with cool efficiency. Though he didn't like having had his mission command posture usurped, he was impressed by her style and her ability to improvise. He was also damned curious and a little excited to see where all of this would lead, despite the fact that he was already up to his neck in waters that were definitely rising.
Chapter 53. Tuesday, 10:07 p.m., Habarovsk.
With all the high-tech wizardry the military had put at his disposal, Charlie Squires couldn't understand why they didn't have non-fog night-vision goggles instead of these foggles, as the Strikers had nicknamed them. Sweat pooled on the inside bottom of the lenses, and if you covered your mouth with a muffler, as he'd tried to do, the perspiration warmed, turned to vapor, and you couldn't see. If you didn't use the muffler, your lips froze together, and the tip of your nose went numb. A warm face wouldn't matter much if he dropped off the 100-foot-high cliff, so Squires chose to see, as much as one could see with thick snow swirling around. At least he could see the cliff. Squires was descending, buddy-style, with Private Terence Newmeyer. One man started rappelling down the cliff, got a foothold, then extended a hand, and steadied the other as he descended a little further. In the dark, on icy cliffs, Squires didn't want anyone rappelling without something for guidance, though he had to admit these weren't the worst conditions he'd seen. Squires had once been invited to participate with Israel's Sayeret Gevati, the elite reconnaissance brigade, during their Hell Week training. The exercises included climbing down a 24-meter-high cliff and then running an obstacle course. The olive fatigues of the soldiers were ripped to shreds by the end of the drill, though not from the cliff itself. Throughout the descent, officers had been pelting the soldiers with both Arabic epithets and rocks. Compared to that climb, this one, foggles and all, was a day at the beach. About 15 yards from the bottom, 5 yards to their left, Squires heard Sandra yell at them to wait. Squires looked down and saw her huddled close to her climbing partner, Private Walter Pupshaw. "What's wrong?" Squires shouted as he stole a quick look at the horizon. He was searching for smoke from the locomotive and didn't see it. Yet.
"He's frozen to the cliff," Sandra yelled back. "He tore his pant leg on a rock,"